This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Most people read the biblical story about the Tower of Babel as a divine curse. Once all mankind spoke a single language and erected an ancient skyscraper until God confounded their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. Hopelessly confused, the people stopped construction and scattered across the face of the earth. Mark Abley reads this story differently, as a gift as well as a restraining order on human ambition. Thanks to this blessing, he writes, Noah's heirs are free to play and work and worship in a multitude of voices. About 6,000 or so, depending on how you count, in Manx and Boro and Tiwi and Yiddish. But if the fears of experts are realized, 90% of those tongues will be silent by the end of this century, a profound event in human history and an incalculable loss. Language is politics, culture, identity, music, a way of thought. Later in the program, the possible demise of one of the iconic brand names of the digital age and a remembrance of Herb Brooks and what some call the greatest sporting event of the 20th century. But first, endangered languages. If you care about their survival, if you've thought through the implications of the loss, or if you feel fewer dominant languages would bring people together and improve communication, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And Mark Abley joins us now. His book is Spoken Here, Travels Among Threatened Languages. He joins us from the CBC studios in Montreal, Canada. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks very much, Neil.
So what started you, you're not a linguist, what started you on this quest to hunt down and examine threatened languages?
I grew up caring a lot about endangered species of animals, but I was very clearly not going to be a biologist or a scientist. I was going to be a writer. And when I was growing up, I just took it for granted growing up in Western Canada that English was dominant. It never even occurred to me that Cree and Blackfoot and other languages had been spoken and indeed were still spoken in parts of the land where I was growing up. It was only when I became an adult and was working as a journalist in Montreal that I really began to take this subject seriously. And I remember especially visiting one elderly lady in a community called Odenak, which is east of Montreal. It's just a small town, a couple thousand people. And this lady is one of the very last speakers of the Abenaki language, which was once quite widespread across New England. Thoreau met a group of Abenakis in the woods of Maine, for example, in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Now it's just spoken in a few communities by a few elderly people. And to meet this lady in her 80s, who was still so committed to this language that she was trying to teach it in night classes once a week to middle-aged people in her community, that made a huge impact on me.
One of the things you write about in the book is you made the comparison already to endangered species, but those are creatures of flesh and bone and feather. Language is almost literally air.
That's right. Or and among deaf people who use sign language, it's air as moved around in the hand. So a language doesn't really exist as a living entity except when people speak it and use it and listen to it. So it's true that there could be languages that will survive on paper the way that Latin or ancient Greek has done, but I still think it would be an immense loss if languages are no longer spoken in communities right around the world.
One of the ways you phrase that dilemma is that we in the West, with our command of English and the way it structures the world and our command of technology, think we know all the answers, but if we don't have a lot of languages, we may not know all the questions.
That's absolutely right, because I believe very strongly that each language helps set out the way in which you see the world. There are practical possibilities. I mean, I could make a practical argument for saving languages. For example, I discovered that on the west coast of Canada, there's a language called Haukamelam, spoken only by several hundred people now, I believe. And their word for what we would call a kind of wild ginger, literally it means a device for the heart. And possibly, who knows, that plant may have, you know, very practical applications. But it's difficult to argue too much for the practical aspect of saving languages. I guess what really concerns me is all the ways of seeing, the ways of feeling, the ways of being in the world that languages embody and that are already, as we speak, dying out.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address totn@npr.org. And Albert joins us on the line from Rochester, New York.
How you doing?
Okay.
You know, the thing is, when I announced this program, I thought, well, it's kind of like thumbing your nose at evolution. I mean, humans evolve, you know, have been evolving for hundreds of thousands of years, and so have their communication skills, you know. And basically, I think if everyone could pick one language, you know, it would make communications and technology a lot easier. I imagine translating a computer handbook into Urdu or some other obscure language would be a lot more difficult than just mass producing it in, say, English or French or Russian or choose your language.
Mark Abley?
Yeah, that's one of the arguments that people sometimes make, Albert, so thanks for making it. I guess I would say that because we speak one of the languages which is taking over the world, it's easy for us to have that particular attitude. You know, if someone told you that it was going to be necessary for you to speak Chinese and that you wouldn't be able to speak English anymore and that Chinese was the way of the future, you might not really be so happy about that. And so I found often in talking to people that once they begin to think about how they would feel if their own language was under attack, was under siege, it was no longer being learned by children, if it was no longer possible to use it in the workplace, for example, that then their point of view might be somewhat different.
We're not talking about total. Aren't the people that you're talking about in some of these small languages bilingual in that language and another language? They're not totally losing it. It's just dropping by the wayside because it's not, you know, it's kind of hard to transact business in the language.
I'd say in return that there are cases, and Hebrew in the state of Israel is a very good one, where the people of Israel and before that who settled in Palestine late in the 19th and early in the 20th century made a very strong commitment to keep their ancestral language alive. And now Hebrew is used in business right across Israel. And there are a few other examples as well of small languages that are going strong and that have been actually revived. So if there's a popular desire on the part of a people, as there is in Israel, to keep that language alive, then surprising things can happen.
That's the crux of the matter, right, where you said popular desire. It's, you know, when you have kids come, like, if I was a teenager, I'm not a teenager, I'm in my 40s. But if I was a teenager in China, you know, trying to listen to a Britney Spears video in English when all I can speak is Mandarin, that might present a problem. And I'm sure in some of the smaller languages like Flemish or Welsh, I mean, you have run into the same problems.
Well, Albert, thanks very much for the observation. We appreciate the phone call.
Yep.
Many of the languages in Mark Abley's book are very obscure, found in very faraway places. Many, though, are in danger of disappearing right here from the North American continent. One example is Mohawk. Joining us now is Ganya Dario Gilbert, and I'm sure I'm massacring that first part of the name. He's council chief for the Mohawk community of Ganawaki, and he joins us from his office in Ganawaki, located just across the St. Lawrence River from Montreal in Canada. And I apologize if I mispronounce your name, sir.
That's okay. I get that a lot.
How many people speak Mohawk now?
I guess it's difficult at this point to put a specific number on it. I would say, though, that our language is one that did come close to that brink of extinction, at least in my community, and now it's on that path of revitalizing itself.
And how did that come about?
Through different measures, mostly done through the education system. About 20 years ago, Ganawaga took control of our own education system in terms of our curriculum. We instituted Mohawk classes for all age levels. And then about 15 years ago, we started having Mohawk immersion classes for elementary school students. In addition to that, we had a radio station founded about 25 years ago that was geared towards promoting the language, and so little things like this help.
None of that is easy, and none of that is cheap. Why is it important?
Why is it important? Well, as some of our elders over here tell us, 90% of your culture is in your language, and if you lose your language, then there's 90% of your culture.
And culture, of course, is identity. You're a nation. You're a people.
Correct.
Our listeners can't see how your name is spelled, and surely from my pronunciation, they don't really have a pretty very good idea of how it's pronounced. But there's an apostrophe and a colon in your name. What role do they play in pronunciation?
Okay, well, I guess you got the misspelled version of my name. There is no apostrophe, but there is a colon. And about in 1989, I believe it was, the Mohawk communities in our region got together and decided we wanted to standardize the spelling for, well, we call it Ganyogeha. That's our language, the name for our language in mm-hmm. our language.
Mohawk, one of those names that was applied by other people to you.
Right, right. So we standardized the spelling, and these were some of the different grammatical signatures, I guess you could call them, that we placed into our dialect, our written dialect. And in my case, my name, what the colon represents is between the two I's. What the colon represents is you extend the sound of the letter preceding the colon. So in my case, my name is Ganyadario.
I see.
Extend the first I there.
There's two I's between the R and the O there, and there's a colon between them, and that's when you extend it.
Right.
Are there terms or a mode of thought in Mohawk that doesn't exist in English that you could demonstrate for us?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Is there an expression in Mohawk or a way of thinking that doesn't exist in English that you could show us or demonstrate for us?
Well, I think that all languages lose a lot in the translation, and I guess that's what you're getting at.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's see. Let's say, for example, I say to somebody, Gunorukwa. Now, roughly translated into English, that means I love you. However, if you break down the word Gunorukwa, what it actually means is to, you're expressing joy in the person you're addressing, and you're acknowledging that it's good to see them, and the good medicine or the good feelings that you have between them, you hope that that is wrapped around each, you know, to bond you.
Do you at this point have, do you think that Mohawk, the language that we call Mohawk, is going to survive?
Yes.
Well, good luck.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate your being with us very much, and I'm going to try to pronounce it one more time. Ganyadario Gilbert is council chief of the Mohawk community of the Ganawakni, which is Ganawaki, which is located across the St. Lawrence River from Montreal. He was with us from his office there in Canada. And Mark Abley, Mohawk is one of the languages that you discuss in detail, and one of the things that he was telling us about misspellings of various names, well, that's an issue. That's a living issue, isn't it?
Oh, it's a huge issue. And I was surprised, you know, in the traveling I did for this book to find that it's an issue with a lot of minority communities, because a lot of languages, small languages, are oral. They don't really exist too much on paper. They're starting to exist now more and more on paper and also online. The community of Ganawaki, for example, has an excellent website, which is in Mohawk as well as in English. But Mohawk is spoken in upstate New York, in Ontario, and in southwestern Quebec. And I don't mean any offense to Mohawk people by saying that. Mohawk people themselves, a lot of them would say that, well, this is their territory and they're not part of the United States or Canada. But geographically, that's where their communities are located. One of the problems is that the version of Mohawk that might be spoken in southwestern Ontario would have a certain spelling and use a certain form of some of the words. The version in upstate New York would be a bit different, and the version at Ganawaki or Ganasataki in Quebec would be different again. And when a language is threatened and is not spoken by that many people, no one likes to feel that their version is being appropriated by someone else.
You're one of the very few if you speak Manx, Yuchi, or Tiwi. We're talking about endangered languages, what we lose when a language dies, and how to keep them alive. 800-989-8255, TOTN at npr.org. Back after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about endangered languages with Mark Abley, the author of Spoken Here, Travels Among Threatened Languages. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. I wanted to bring up an email that we got from Carolyn Bowler in Anchorage, Alaska. She wrote, wasn't it Socrates who said that a man wasn't it Socrates who said that a man who speaks two languages sees with two souls? And I guess that addresses the issue of bilingualism.
Yeah, bilingualism is a huge issue in many countries, not just in the United States and Canada. And often it can be the saving of small languages. Sometimes it can be a threat to small languages. Everything depends on the individual case. But I guess I would say that I personally feel very enriched by speaking French as well as English. I wish I spoke more languages. I feel, you know, impoverished in a way by only speaking two.
Let's get another caller in. An Petu joins us. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, from Hotchkiss, Colorado.
Hi. I'm Peter.
Okay.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, my name is a Lakota name, Anpeto Ihankeshni, and I've had experience with some other Native American languages as well. But one of the things I was calling about that I was talking to the person who was filling the call is I was traveling in India about 10 years ago in southern India in the state of Karnataka, studying plants, and I was visiting a large extended family that were spice farmers in this one village, and after taking me through the forest to look at plants, I heard this very melodious chanting as we were coming back, and I was magnetically drawn to it, and there was this large room in one building in the village compound, and I looked in, there were about 80 or 90 people there, from their like late 70s or 80s down to very young children, 4 or 5 years old, and they were being taught Sanskrit. It was a team of three women who were part of a Sanskrit revitalization program that was going all over southern India. There were many teams of this, and they had devised a method to teach from the youngest to the oldest how to revive Sanskrit as a spoken language. And it was utterly magnetic. I was totally entranced by it. But it would be equivalent for listeners to gauge an idea as if Latin or Aramaic, for instance, was to be a living language again, spoken.
Yeah, Mark Abley, there are efforts to revive languages. As you mentioned, Hebrew, certainly that worked.
That's a wonderful story you just told. I was really moved by that. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of revitalization efforts, and I would say that when you look at things from as if from a great height, as if from a vantage point looking down on all these small languages, then you might think, well, there's not much hope, they're all going to die out. But on an individual level, that's not the case at all, and time after time I found that there were people who were really fighting hard to save their language, fighting hard to make sure it is learned by children and still spoken by teenagers and so on. And that's tremendous. That's one of the things that gives me hope, is the knowledge that it's not just, you know, writers and romantics like me who care about languages. It's also people in so many communities in the United States and Canada, all around the world, who are doing what they can to save their language.
If I might share one quick other story about that with you, please.
Sure. Go ahead.
As a kid, I had an observing interest in Native American culture for many, many years. I had a mentor who, his mentor was Frank Speck, who during the first half of the last century was the foremost, as an anthropological authority on the Indians of the Eastern Woodlands. And my friend George Snyderman, I was in my young teens at the time, and George was in his 50s. I used to hang out with him on weekends, and he would play ceremonial music for me from the Longhouse, from the Seneca, where he had spent quite a bit of time. So when I was 13, after going to the World's Fair in Montreal, which was just kind of my excuse to get up there, my father took me around. He could never really understand my interest in Native American culture. We went to visit different Iroquois reservations, which was really what I wanted to do. And we wound up at one point in outside of Brantford on the Six Nations Reserve on Oshwekan, which Mark may be familiar with.
That's right. I spent some time there, yeah.
And this was like in the early 60s. There were no, you know, young white kids going around who were interested in Indian culture at that point. And I was really interested from my association with George, my older friend, with Iroquois religion and culture. So they were very taken with it, and they invited my father and myself to come. There was a marriage ceremony that was going on in the longhouse that they wanted us to attend. And it was in Cayuga and, I believe,
Seneca, perhaps, or Mohawk?
Another Iroquois language, but it might have been, it wasn't Onondaga, but
There's five or six that are spoken there.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was just looking at the expression on my father's face because he had never heard anything like that before. There was just something about the cadence, the emotive quality in the language itself, and its connection with the living cultural continuity that moved him very deeply in a way that by the time we got back to Philadelphia, where I grew up, he said, "I'm really glad you're interested in Indian culture. It's really a good thing." You know, it was just very moving, the kind of way that speaking different languages creates a whole other dimension of human experience, and even hearing them. I mean, if one looks at the popularity kind of world beat music at this time, I think it also speaks very cogently to this issue.
Oh, well, interesting observation. Thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
One of the things we lose when a language dies is an attitude toward life. Yiddish may be a good example. Rivka Augenfeld joins us now. She's an advocate of Yiddish culture who lives in Montreal, and very nice of you to be with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
How would you characterize a Yiddish worldview?
Well, I was thinking about it, actually, and I think one of the things that Basheva Singer, who was, you know, the only Nobel Prize winner who wrote originally in Yiddish but is known to most people in the world in English and in other languages, he said Yiddish is a language that never had a government. So you don't have a lot of that vocabulary that comes with government and power. And he also said there's no vocabulary in Yiddish for the details of war and the waging of war. It really is a language of people who mostly didn't have power, but who invested a lot in survival, but survival with an enormous sense of humor, because I think you have a tremendous fund of sort of source and wonderful, you know, things said in sarcastic ways and humorous ways, the subtleties of human relationships, the subtleties of human character, and many, many words for different nuances of character and types. And I think, and a lot of that has crept into American English. American English is suffused with a lot of these words.
As we've learned many of them from Jewish comedians. Who
yes,
certainly,
and because, and I think again, you know, because show business and especially films and showbiz was an area where, you know, the kind of discrimination that Jews faced at the beginning of the century was not as present, you have the impact of all of that language as well.
Now, Yiddish is a language, some complained, I guess, that it wasn't really a language, just a corruption of German.
Well, every language starts somewhere. It's just that this one started at a point in history that can be more or less identified. It's an offshoot of Middle High German and then developed on its own. It's unique in the sense that the people who spoke it traveled very quickly to different places. So you have Yiddish taking on a different personality, if you will, but just clothing-wise, you know, of the countries in which people settled. So Yiddish spoken by Jews in Russia versus Poland versus Hungary versus, you know, Germany is changed, took on more vocabulary from the languages among whom people lived, but has a syntax which, although it derives from German, more closely resembles English, because in Yiddish, most of the time, and there are, of course, many exceptions, you have the subject, verb, object, but you have, it's written with the Hebrew characters and therefore is written from right to left and has an important component of Hebrew vocabulary in it, especially when talking about more traditional things. But so a Yiddish speak, I myself, I always say I'm from a mixed marriage, but my mother is from a city which was called Vilna. When she was born, it was in Poland, but it's now called Vilnius and it's in Lithuania. It hasn't moved, but the borders moved. And my father is from Warsaw, which has always been part of Poland, even though it was ruled by Russians at one point. And their accents are different. Some of their vocabulary is different. probably my father's made more of an accommodation, but the language of Vilna became more of the standard Yiddish in a way where, you know, you have so many variants of English, but there is a standard spelling and there is a standard, you know, like, let's say the pronunciation, and often people with accents that are more regional are encouraged when they're speaking publicly to kind of minimize their regional accents. But it has some of those characteristics that you might find in English across different countries and across different regions.
I grew up in and around the city of New York and mm-hmm. heard a fair amount of Yiddish, though my family's not Jewish, yeah. but you couldn't help it. Anderson Theater in those days was still an yeah. active Yiddish theater on Second Avenue. Could for those who aren't familiar with it, could you mm-hmm. Give us a few phrases, give us what the sound of the language is like?
Well, again, I can do it to you in two ways because, you know, I speak publicly like my mother, let's say, from the standard Yiddish of Vilna, and then there is the standard Yiddish of Vilna. So I could say to you, let's say I'll say to you that I'm very happy to be on this show, right? And I'll say, ich bin sehr zufrieden zu sein mit euch heute auf euer Programm. And if I said it more the Warsaw way, I would say, ich bin sehr zufrieden han zu sein mit euch auf euer Programm. Now, there's some subtleties of vowel shifts more than anything.
And I'm sorry, were you trying to say something, Mark?
No, I was looking with great interest at Rivka Sena.
You're both in the same studio, I should point out, yeah. there in Montreal at the CBC studios.
Yeah.
Mark, one of the interesting things that you said was that the founders of the State of Israel considered the idea of which language that they would promulgate, and Yiddish lost out to Hebrew.
Yeah, in fact, you know, Rivka's probably more of an expert on this than I am, but... Theodor Herzl, who the great leader of the Zionist movement in the late 19th century, did certainly speak Yiddish himself and considered Yiddish being the language of Jews in the Holy Land. But he wanted to have, as I understand it, a sort of inclusive language, and the Sephardic Jews, the Jews who had lived in Spain and the Mediterranean area and who had spread out to Yemen and other places, they really didn't have any sense of Yiddish. But the men among them, the men and the boys, spoke Hebrew, just as the men and boys who spoke Yiddish in daily life also spoke Hebrew in holy settings. And so Herzl and his followers decided that Hebrew rather than Yiddish should be the inclusive language for Jews in what would become Israel.
I think, if I could add something to that, I think it's true that Yiddish is one of a number of Jewish languages. There's Ladino, there's Judeo-Arab, there's Judeo-Espanol, there's and others. But what happened in Israel, in order to make Hebrew supreme, Yiddish was really almost persecuted, and it's not too strong a word. There were laws, people were ridiculed, there was an enormous amount of pressure not to use Yiddish, because there was a feeling that if, especially after the Second World War, when a lot of refugees arrived from Europe, you know, Holocaust survivors to Israel, that if there weren't extreme measures taken, that they would make Yiddish somehow prominent. And a lot of different things happened, which I think now people try to deny, but people who lived through it and are still alive will tell you it all happened. But now the irony is that there are Yiddish courses in Israel. Yiddish gets a certain amount of state support. There is a chair of Yiddish studies, I think at Bar-Ilan University, I'm not sure. And ironically, and I think Mark touches on it in his book, when the great influx of the new immigration from the former Soviet Union arrived, there were Yiddish writers and there were Yiddish speakers. And by then, they were allowed to work more freely. And part of a certain kind of rejuvenation of Yiddish literature has happened with the arrival of writers from the former Soviet Union.
Well, Rivka Augenfeld, thank you very much for being with us. Can you tell us goodbye in Yiddish?
A guten Tag. Seid gesund. Means be well.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're still speaking with Mark Abley. He's the author of Spoken Here, Travels Among Threatened Languages. Our phone number is still 800-989-8255. And let's get a call from Jenny, who's with us from Savannah, Georgia.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to respond to something that a gentleman said a little bit earlier on your program, which is if languages are being learned as a way of getting economic power, such as he said something about why shouldn't everyone just learn a few languages if that'll, you know, simplify things for technology.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've had experiences in West Africa, specifically in Niger, and I can shed a little bit of light on why people originally, why the popular desire arises to become bilingual and then the problems that come with that afterwards. A lot of smaller communities of minority languages, when there's a certain promise of learning English or French or an international language, a promise of economic power. You know, when all people want to do is earn more money so that they can buy food or clothing for their families. Well, one or two generations down the line, they can realize that other issues exist which also help to keep them in poverty. And so even though they may speak these languages, issues of racism, issues of, you know, the fact that the marketplace is a very, very complex thing, mm-hmm. and they just can't compete in the world market, all of those arise, and they realize that, you know, through the translation of their lives into another culture, they have lost their original culture. And then so there's a lot of backpedaling. This has happened in Niamey, Niger, with the case of French, where parents now are not wanting to send their children to French schools because the children are losing respect for their elders, they're losing respect for the traditions, and also the children are learning to see their own history through the light of another language instead of purely through their own culture.
Mark Abley, this is a lot of what you write about.
That's a really good point, Jenny. Thank you for making it. Another thing I would say, using African examples, is that people sometimes think, well, if only we spoke one language, there would be peace. There wouldn't be political strife the way there is in the world today. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you look at the African countries that have the most unilingualism, the least number of languages, those countries are Somalia and Rwanda. And you look at the fate of Somalia and Rwanda in the last 10 or 15 years, and those are obviously two of the most devastated countries. And yet other countries like Cameroon, where there are hundreds of languages that are still spoken, Cameroon has not fallen into civil war and chaos and genocide the way that Rwanda and Somalia have.
Mm-hmm. Jenny, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we just have a minute left in this segment, Mark, but clearly language is also extremely powerful politics away from the African continent. You write some about the Basque language.
The Basque was revived in the 20th century, as was Welsh, which is a language that's dear to my heart because my parents were born inside Wales, very much thanks to a particular writer. And the influence of writers and artists on small languages is something we haven't really had time to touch on, but sometimes that's really strong. Unfortunately, what can happen is that the desire to save a culture becomes almost obsessive, and you find people who turn to violence. And so, unfortunately, Basque is now known in much of the rest of the world for its political terrorism, and there's really a lot more to it than that.
We're speaking with Mark Abley, the author of Spoken Here, Travels Among Threatened Languages. More, including a Welsh speaker, after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, part three in our series on youth, we'll talk about a recent White House report on mental health that says too many children are not getting the help they need and that schools can do more. What do you think? That's tomorrow at this time on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're talking about endangered languages. Oh. a song called Bosobe, as performed by the Aka Pygmies of the Congo Basin in Africa. The CD called African Rhythms was created to try to preserve this unique polyphonic music and language. And there can be few languages that music plays a more central role in than in Welsh. And Mark Abley, you were talking about how important this language is to you. Mark Abley is the author of Spoken Here, Travels Among Threatened Languages, and how it came to life to you when you started hearing people sing it.
Yeah, I just to backtrack a little tiny bit, Welsh is one of the six Celtic languages that still survives. People may be more familiar with Irish Gaelic or Scots Gaelic, because the Irish and the Scots have been very successful around the world, especially in North America, in making their culture known. Welsh, I've always felt, is a little more discreet, a little more subtle, a little less in your face. And one of the central things about the Welsh language is the way that male voice choirs and traditional singing, and nowadays untraditional singing as well, happens in Welsh. So that you have country songs in Welsh, you have rock songs in Welsh. It's not just the case that the Welsh language survives only in the traditional male voice choirs. It's also the case that if you're a teenager growing up in Wales, you can hear hip-hop in Welsh.
We have a Welsh speaker with us. Annette Pritchard joins us now. She grew up speaking Welsh on the island of Anglesey in North Wales and emigrated to Canada 30 years ago. She now lives in Toronto, where she joins us on the phone. And good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
Hello. I apologize. We've squeezed the time and have only a couple of minutes left, and I do apologize. Certainly Welsh, as the recrudescence of Welsh deserves more time than that. There is a television station that broadcasts in Welsh, radio as well. The preservation of this language seems extraordinary.
Yes, and I think, as you say, the television station called S4C, or S4C, has been responsible for a lot of that in the last few years.
There are children speaking Welsh growing up. This is vital, as Mark Abley, you write in your book. If children have this wonderful adaptability to language that we grown-ups can't possibly duplicate, and if the children will grow up to speak it, then the language is alive and thriving.
That's right. I don't know, Nest, when you emigrated to Canada, did you think that Welsh would still survive, or were you fairly hopeless at that time?
You see, I came just at that turning point when the Welsh Language Society was beginning to form, and the Welsh nationalist movement was becoming more aggressive and sort of really fighting for the survival of the language, because it was really at a decline at that time. And, you know, it's when I go back now, there's a huge change from the 60s when I left Wales.
Annette Pritchard, does your family there in Toronto speak Welsh at home?
Not really, but my daughter, who is a linguist, has taken Welsh classes and is able to converse a little bit in Welsh, but it's very difficult when there are so few people here who you can converse with. I happen to belong to the Welsh United Church in Toronto, and that's really the one place where we meet as a group of Welsh people who do have an opportunity of practicing the language.
Annette Pritchard, thank you very much for being with us. And again, I apologize for squeezing the time down. We appreciate your being with us. Thank you very much. She was on the line with us from Toronto, where she joined us by phone from her home. And Mark Abley, thank you very much as well. We really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Neil.
Mark Abley is... book is Spoken Here, Travels Among Threatened Languages. He joined us from the studios of CBC Radio in Montreal.